gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It does feel good. It's the Stephanie Miller Show, and I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and Jim and Chris while they are away on vacation. We're, of course, streaming live. I'm messing with the camera right now. On Ustream at HalSparks.com or Ustream.tv. And, of course, you can follow us on in the chat room there. You can also follow me on Twitter and be involved in the conversation, which is going to be relatively intense today, I think, because there's so much backstory, I think, to this, I don't know, what do we call him? The underwear bomber? Do we call him the underwear? I like it. I think it's catchy. I think underwear bomber works. I'm gonna stick with that. Cause Christmas bomber, nah, that just sounds wrong anyways. Cause it somehow makes him nicer. It doesn't ruin Christmas. It doesn't make Christmas worse. It makes him better. Oh, he's the Christmas bomber. You know, that's not helpful. So I think underwear bomber we will stick with for the better part of the program today. In the last 48 hours especially, there's been a huge focus on Yemen. Because if any of you got a chance to check out Rachel Maddow's show last night, she, I think, did a fantastic job. You can obviously catch it on demand or on their site. You can also – I have the – MSNBC iPhone app there. I admitted it. There's a Rachel Maddow app, and you can actually watch the show from there. But she did a great piece connecting the dots on how many – well, not the – I guess dots, really pointing to the fact that the web, essentially, of terrorism we've been dealing with over the last few years in particular has come specifically from Yemen, and largely – it makes sense that it comes from Yemen on a couple of fronts. One, it's a very poor country. There's a lot of land that they can exploit and hide in. Al-Qaeda can build strongholds there. It's buttressed right up against Saudi Arabia, which is one of our odd allies. So it makes it difficult for us in a lot of ways to march in there the way we did in Afghanistan, which doesn't necessarily – we're not stepping on as many toes, as it were. And interestingly enough, you know, a lot of you will remember the 9/11 hijackers. A lot of them came from Saudi Arabia. A lot of the material support was created in kind of that general area. Anyways, Yemen's a tough spot, and it's right across the water from Somalia, which is a failed state. So there's a lot of free land there with a lot of radicals, a lot of poverty. There's apparently a huge gun and basically – I guess missiles as well, but there's a huge arms sales area in Yemen that happens on a fairly regular basis where a lot of this stuff is traded freely, and that's not very reassuring considering what we're starting to find out about Yemen. Now, the upside is the upside is that I was right. Okay, remember yesterday when I was talking about, if those of you that weren't here, you're forgiven. Yesterday I was bringing up that a lot of this is actually this bomber on this flight, and the idea that there may have been other things planned actually has a lot to do, quite frankly, I think, with our actions previous, that it was in retaliation for our actions in the last few weeks. Specifically, we've been targeting Al-Qaeda leaders in Yemen, and what they ended up doing was sending people in response to that. Now, there's some hashing about the timeline, but there's a couple of things that really point to, I think, I almost wish that Jim Ward was here, because I think he more than anybody would be able to appreciate what the sort of the backstory leading up to this. Okay, first of all, we start with the Bush administration. Okay, this is probably one of the most fascinating details of the whole thing, and there are a lot, obviously. Anytime you have a guy who puts an incendiary device in his underwear, there's going to be a lot of interesting details. There's no question about that. People are going to be excited. They're going to want to know what's behind it all. Is it the new fashion, stuffing your underwear with PETN, which is an incendiary explosive that apparently has to be confined in a space and compacted to actually go off unless you have a secondary chemical reaction, which is why these guys are unable to set their shoes and their underwear off, as it were, and they just catch fire. So PTN's been tried a couple of times. It was actually, apparently this guy got it from his support in Yemen. He spent, I think, 80 days there prepping and learning how to do this. Now, but who are these people in Yemen? Who are the Al-Qaeda leaders that are there? I mean, we've been after the Al-Qaeda leaders that are involved in the Taliban. They're the ones that are hiding with Osama bin Laden, who's apparently dead, but we can't officially say that. Anyways, he's been that's been in the mountains of Tora Bora and the Pakistan-Afghanistan region. This has been a big hub and a very important space for Al-Qaeda. Who are these people in Yemen? Okay, two of the four leaders that were allegedly behind the Al-Qaeda plot to blow up the flight into Detroit, according to American officials and Defense Department documents. These are people we released from Guantanamo in 2007 under George Bush. Okay, so two of the leaders that were in charge of setting up the bombing on that would have been the Christmas Day bombing had it been successful were released from Guantanamo by George Bush into the hands of the Saudis. Now, what did the Saudis plan to do with these two gentlemen? There were two of them specifically. Guantanamo prisoner number 333. There were two of them. Wait, 333. What's 2 times 333? I'm getting all Glenn Beck. Do you see that? Was that good? All right. His name was Mohammed Atiq Al-Harbi, and prisoner 372, Saeed Al-Shari, were sent to Saudi Arabia on November 9th, 2007. Who was president at that time? When they were letting people go from Guantanamo that were actually dangerous? I forget. Anyways, according to Defense Department log of detainees who were released from American custody, Al-Harbi has since changed his name, by the way, to Muhammad Al-Afwi. So don't, if you're trying to call and you're getting the wrong number, and someone goes, "No, that's not him. That's somebody else. That guy lives someplace else now. We've lived in this apartment since May. We keep getting calls." Okay, don't call, because he's changing. Okay, both Saudi nationals, they were Saudis, have appeared in leadership roles in Yemen. They were both released into Saudi custody for a rehabilitation program that uses art. That's right. They were released into the hands of the Saudis, and the Saudis' intention was to rehabilitate them and turn them into good, hardworking, friendly citizens by giving them crayons and paint. I'm not kidding. This is part of a rehabilitation program that, by the way, a U.S. diplomat, and I quote, said, "The so-called rehabilitation programs are a joke," said a U.S. diplomat in describing the Saudi efforts with released Guantanamo detainees. So pretty much anybody we hand over to the Saudis, they're giving a paintbrush and apparently classes on how to make a syringe detonator. But so two of those guys released under the Bush administration into the hands of the Saudis, whom I know you're going to say, well, Bush didn't have a good relationship with the Saudis. He doesn't know those guys. Not like he holds hands and kisses them in public. So anyways, two of them, and I would like to say for the record, and I will totally cop to this as a progressive, as a liberal, as someone who clearly has a history of tree hugging there. I admitted it. I said it on the open airways. The amazing part of this is this sounds like something we did. This sounds like something that they accused the progressives and liberals of. You probably want to release these guys so they can sit around a drum circle and learn to do finger painting. Like, that sounds like something they would accuse us of. And this is the Bush administration. This is what Dick Cheney signed off on. This is what Dick Cheney thought would be the best use of, okay, we've got these guys. Now, keep in mind, when Obama got in office, we released the Uyghurs shortly thereafter, and there was a huge uproar about the Uyghurs. You're letting them loose. These Chinese dissidents who have been given to a little island nation to just hang on for a while where they can actually – they'll stay in kind of a prison area to make sure they're not dangerous. They have access to a beach, and they're very happy and playing in the sand and that kind of thing. But remember the uproar when Obama was going to release these people. Now, these people, the Uyghurs, innocent of anything. They were just scooped up with a bunch of other people. They'd been there for a long time. There's a a kid who was picked up at 15 years old, who's been in Guantanamo, and I believe he was released earlier this year, who turned 21, turned 18 and turned 21 in Guantanamo. Not guilty of anything. Scooped up in one of our standard kind of raids. And we just held on to him because we couldn't think of anything better to do. This was all during the Bush administration. You've got a 16-year-old kid who, even if he did do something, was accused of, you know, hucking a grenade at American forces in his own country because he was taught by everyone around him that these folks are there to kill them. So this is a 15, 16-year-old boy. He was still in jail up till this year. But the Bush administration saw fit to release two leaders of Al-Qaeda, not just random dudes. These guys actually became leaders. They were part of the four-man team that created this plot, which may have actually had some other elements. This is also, you know, I'm not above doing some actual journalism. So I'm actually doing some digging on my own. And I noticed in one of the early reports, when everybody was talking about, they were interviewing people that had come off the plane, that there was the timeline on how this guy got through customs and onto the plane was, to say the very least, a little sketchy. And for any of you that know me and know, honestly, that when I come here on Wednesdays and do Hump Days with Hal, which I will be continuing to do, and we'll actually be streaming the show when I come in. That's the goal, anyways. If they let me, Chris will let me. I don't know if Jim will, but we'll see if we can get Steph on camera from New York. We'll figure it out. Anybody who knows it, when we're off camera, when we're off the air, Jim and I go into conspiracy corner, and we're very happy there. We play with our blocks, and we connect the dots in a way that I think would make the producers of Loose Change cringe sometimes. You know, like, I think that's a bit of a reach for me, dude. There was one thing that stuck out for me that was really very strange, and they were talking about how he actually got on without a passport. And one of the people who, and I have it, one of the guys who watched them get on the plane was quoted, and I saw this quote, and I had to pull it because it's kind of stunning. Keep in mind, this is a guy getting on a plane with an Arab name and with no baggage, bought his ticket in cash. Okay, we've heard all that part of the story. How in the world did he get on a plane into the United States with nothing? Okay, there was a guy who was standing. His name was, I believe it was Kurt Haskell. And he said, I was on the flight today and thankful to be alive. Blah, blah, blah. He talks about what actually happened on the plane. But then he talks about the fact that I was next to the terrorist when he checked in at the Amsterdam airport early on Christmas. My wife and I were playing cards directly in front of the check-in counter. This is what I saw, and he related to the FBI, apparently he said this. An Indian man in a nicely dressed suit around age 50 approached the check-in counter with the terrorist and said, this man needs to get on this flight and he has no passport. The two of them are an odd pair, as the terrorist is a short black man. He looked very poor and looks around 17, although I think he's 23, he doesn't look it. It did not cross my mind that they were terrorists, only that they looked weird together. The ticket taker said, you can't board without a passport. The Indian man then replied, he is from Sudan. We do this all the time. I can only take this from this to mean that it is difficult to get passports from Sudan, and this was some sort of sympathy ploy. The ticket taker then said, you will have to talk to my manager, and sent the two down a hallway. I never saw the Indian man again, as he wasn't on the flight. It was also weird that the terrorist never said a word in this exchange. Anyway, somehow the terrorist still made it onto the plane. I'm not sure if it was a bribe or just sympathy from the security manager. Okay, that's, I would say, important. I think, you know, people will be screaming. We'll talk about, after I come back from the break, why this was not a failure of TSA, for one, because this happened in another country. This is U.S. Customs agents and the Border Patrol there, because that's how we operate outside. This isn't just the regular guys you run into at Chicago O'Hare. So all of Jim DeMint's freakouts and blaming unions for that, and we'll play audio of what he thinks the problem is. We'll play that when we get back. But I also want to play a secondary aspect of the story that happened when they landed and the FBI removed somebody else from the scene. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We'll get to your calls a little bit, but this is a little creepy. We'll be back right after this.
So much fun, it should be illegal.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Show. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph while she's away on vacation. Of course, Jim and Chris are on vacation. At least I hope they are. I hope they're having a great time. So right before the break, 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We got a couple of calls. I'll get to you guys after this next break because I've only got a short bit of time here. But I want to address right before the break, I was talking about how one of the passengers on the flight on Christmas Day that the underwear bomber was on, he saw this guy get on the plane. He saw this guy go through security and be allowed on the plane. Now, later on, once they all landed and they were kind of separated out and supposedly the incident was over, apparently this guy had also seen an Indian man who helped him get on the plane. This was his description. Whether the guy's actually Indian or whatever, we don't know. I wouldn't rush to that. But later on, he said this: the FBI also arrested a different Indian man while we were held in customs after a bomb-sniffing dog detected a bomb in his carry-on bag, and he was searched after we landed. This was later confirmed when we were in customs when an FBI agent said to us, "You are being moved to another area because this area is not safe." Read between the lines. Some of you saw what just happened, the arrest of the other Indian man. I'm not sure why this hasn't made it into any news story, but I stood about 15 to 20 feet away from the other Indian man as he was cuffed and arrested after this search. Now, I won't jump to immediately thinking that that's indeed the case. And a lot of times after a situation like this, the police will err on the side of safety to the extreme. And they'll later turn people loose that were clearly not involved. And we've had major situations in the past. I mean, even the Olympics, when we had the bomber there, there was that went on forever. This was just a short thing. We'll never know what happened to the second guy, but it's interesting that this detail is here. Now, once we've got the bomber in custody, my concern, and I think a lot of other people, goes to how do we dismantle the system that got him here in the first place, that got him into this. So we'll address a little bit of that and what I think is actually behind why this guy was able to even do this. How did he even get here? And are we safer because of the actions of our government? I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'll get to your calls when we come back right after this. We got John in Redding and David in San Francisco and Andy in Madison. We'll get to you guys and then more callers on there. So, stick with us. We're streaming live on Ustream at HalSparks.com. And, of course, you can follow me on Twitter at HalSparks. 1-800-STEP-12. I'm Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in. I can't not let the phrase play out. I mean, you got Bullet Boys playing, and you can't just cut them off in the middle. They only had one hit. That would just be rude. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I want to go to John in Redding, Pennsylvania. Johnny, there?
Yeah, good morning, Hal.
Morning.
I am a progressive, and I'm just about any social issue, I'm right there with you.
Uh-huh.
Here's my problem with progressive viewpoint on radical Islamic terrorists, and
uh-huh.
That is this. Yeah, let me paraphrase the progressive point of view, which is if we would disengage from Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, etc., that we would decrease the incentive for radical Islamic attacks on this country and this country's interests.
Uh-huh.
And that's probably true to an extent. But the problem is this.
I mean, if you take them at their word, it certainly is. Then if you follow the
spike
in actions, the more we engage, the more that occurs. But go ahead.
I am prepared to agree with you to an extent, but here is the problem. What we really would need to do would be disengage totally from the Middle East, which means we would need to jettison our relationship with Saudi Arabia, regardless of how we feel about that country, Jordan, but most importantly, Israel.
Right.
Are we prepared to do those things in order to basically eliminate the threat of Islamic terrorist threat to this country? And I don't think we are.
I agree. I don't think we are either.
So what's the solution?
Well, the solution is long-term engagement. If you look at, for example, let me give you an example, like Iran right now. The response from the right, largely, if you listen to, and we have that, do we have that John Bolton quote? Okay. Right now in Iran, the protests are ramping up again. They're even more extreme, perhaps, than they were around the elections, for example. And and this is a good example of a country that the American public, I think, spends a lot of time not understanding and yet jumping to conclusions about. A Persian country, a very educated society for the most part. If you look at most of the protest videos, half of them look like they shop here. You know, they look so westernized, and a lot of them have a lot more in common with our culture in that way than we think. And I think there's more of that in the Middle East than we're aware of. The problem is, and you see that to some degree with groups like the Family in the United States, is that once the religious extremists start to lose their grip on it, they start acting out in a very powerful way. I view the Muslim extremists, the one who actually want to do damage, the same way I look at the Columbine kids to some degree, in that I'm not willing to write off all teenagers because of the behavior of these, and I don't think every kid who wears a black coat is a danger to my own safety. I think when you've got over a billion Muslims in the world, even the actions of, like, I think we have 500,000 on the watch list, not even on the no fly list. And these aren't all, by the way, not everybody on that watch list is Muslim, but I would say a large portion of them, since it was formed largely during the last 8 to 10 years, are. The point I'm trying to make is that our engagement there is, if we were smarter about it, if we were less aggressive about our engagement and were willing to be patient with it, it would shift things. The problem is we get impatient, we roll in, we want their resources in some areas, we want to divide the certain countries into chunks in other areas. It creates a quagmire, and then we get blowback.
Well, yeah, and I agree with you, and I think that one could make a case to say that had we been patient with Iraq, there's very good possibility, with no-fly zones in the north, no-fly zones in the south, which we had at the time, that Iraqi people would have overthrown Saddam Hussein.
That's entirely possible. And I think there's a vested interest, I think, in this country and in other countries around the world as far as a corporate view, you know, insofar as the people who want the oil, that's exactly what they didn't want. If the Iraqi people rose up, you might even have a situation like in Venezuela where they nationalized the oil fields. So I do think there was a push on from a business standpoint to get in there. And I think the Bush administration was deeply tied to those kind of interests.
Well, no doubt. They had the oil fields carved up in the segments and who was going to get what.
Right, already. So I totally hear what you're saying, and I appreciate the call. I want to get to David in San Francisco. David, you there? Wait, there you are. David?
Hey, greetings, Phil.
How are you?
Hey, you know, my issue, I look at this like a paranoid with a blank check. Of course, Naomi Klein has written that book about the creative use of the budget when a paranoid gets in charge of the economy.
Oh, the shock doctrine? You mean her book?
Yeah, exactly.
It's an amazing book, by the way. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's a blueprint for how a lot of this stuff actually plays out.
Right.
Even the stuff we are involved in planning, and then, of course, the other stuff that happens without our any instigation by us, but that we also just kind of oh, well, that just happened. Let's dive in and use the tools that we have.
Well, right. And this gets into an interesting dilemma because, you know, obviously people have got hopes that Obama is a progressive and that mm-hmm. he's going to do the right thing as it regards, you know, getting control of the CIA and the FBI and mm-hmm. the various tools of government that he's in charge of. You know, for many, many years, the Bush family and organized crime have had a lot of control of the CIA and the various assets of the U.S. government. You know, I mean, you look at Catch-22, that book was mm-hmm. written 50 years ago, and
right.
they were talking about the same issue.
Well, it's one of the funny things that, like, when they keep bringing up our experience in Afghanistan, and everyone keeps, you know, saying, well, look what happened to the Soviets. This is going to be the lesson. This is what happened when the Soviets fought these people, and this is a situation they got in. Almost forgetting that we backed the Mujahideen and the Yousafzai and all these other groups that included Osama bin Laden at the time, and they beat the Soviets with material support from us.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
And now,
that was kept alive by fake budget,
which, by the way, you kind of have to do. Like, I'm also not completely naive that there are elements in this world. Like I said, I think it equates in some ways to, you know, the law enforcement issue we go through with drug dealers and the like, you know, where you have police having to work, deeply with, you know, undercover, they're going to be involved in ugly things. There's no question about it. And you have to, at some point, uncomfortably weigh the balance.
Well, that's where I was leading with the Obama getting control of the CIA and
right.
the FBI. I mean, many people say that John F. Kennedy was trying to get control of the CIA, and that's why they had a hand in killing him. And so the whole idea about whether or not Obama can do it or whether or not the way I'm looking at it is just in basic taxation with representation,
right.
where the taxpayer, it becomes top secret knowledge, and the taxpayer can never find out how their own taxes are being spent. And so the shock doctrine comes in where
sure.
these guys come up with a new terror thing, budget themselves $10 billion, and the taxpayer never finds out whether it's good or bad, faulty equipment.
Well, that's I think there's reasoning behind this. I appreciate the call. I want to make sure I get to Andy, but I will address that a little bit. I'm not a believer that we have to know everything because, quite frankly, in an open information society, which is what we want, there's certain things that you can't just tell everybody. And it's been one of my problems with, in many ways, the covert actions that the Obama administration has been taking in the Middle East and trying to open paths of diplomacy that have never been there before, do covert acts to eliminate threats, and try to be as surgical about it as possible because they're dealing with what is a very real threat in certain areas. I don't need to know everything. And the Republicans, because they, quite frankly, campaign on this, couldn't do a quarterback sneak to save their life. And they seem to want Obama to put a spotlight on his running back every time he's going to throw to him, if I'm going to use a football analogy. You know, while Bush was in office, they didn't have this problem. Everything had to be on the DL. Nobody could know anything. You know, Pelosi was committing treason because she might be speaking openly about the torture program. She's not allowed to say anything. But now that Obama's in office, they can't wait to try to spill the beans or draw attention to any plan whatsoever. And you cannot tell me that Joe Lieberman, did not know that we've been, he's on the intelligence board. He can't tell me that he didn't know we were doing raids in Yemen and offering material assistance and money and aid and training in Yemen for the couple of weeks leading up to this guy trying to do this. I don't buy it. So basically, I think what he's trying to do is use it to ramp it up. Should we take a break? Yeah. Tony, we're going to take a break. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm going to get to Andy after I get back from this. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also join us in the chat room at Ustream and at HalSparks.com. You can find me on Twitter at HalSparks and be in the conversation there as well. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in on The Stephanie Miller Show.
Wow. Yes. Yes. I love it.
It's The Stephanie Miller Show.
God, sometimes you just don't come through. Do you need a woman to...
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks filling in while they're away on vacation. This may sound soft, but it's not going to stay that way for long. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. Are you crying tonight? There we go. White Lion. Little Fighter. The song about Greenpeace. Good guys. The bass player, by the way, now plays with Zakk Wylde from Black Label Society. Yeah. The bass player from White Lion plays in BLS. That's true. What a weird connection that is. when you say, whoops. So, I want to take, some calls. I have, Tim in Madison, Wisconsin. Tim, you there? Tim?
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great.
You know, I understand. I'm used to Ann Coulter being a hypocrite and, just like crazy, you know.
Right.
As I like to say, BS crazy. But,
it's one of it's the only swear word I wish we could say on the air. The rest of them, I think they should be saved for everywhere else. But
I think they should make an exception for progressive talk.
Badass crazy would be so much fun to use on a regular basis. I hear you. But go ahead.
You know, after September 11th and the years following, she was all for these complete body scans and wanting them installed immediately. She thought they should be in every airport. And
right.
Just for, you know, grins last night, I watched O'Reilly, and here she is saying that, no, she doesn't want them. She thinks it's, you know, for the ACLU, it's against her civil rights for this to be done, and she doesn't want, you know, people to be able to see her naked, probably because they're actually showing who she really is.
Well, it's a danger. I don't, you know, again, I don't stand with the constant, you know, Ann Coulter is a transvestite or a transsexual thing, if only because I know enough, because of my time on Queer as Folk, I know enough transsexuals and transvestites to know that they are good and decent people, and I feel that it would, you know, It's a slight on them that she would be in their ranks. I just think that that's too much for them, and they've been through far too much.
I'm surprised that Ann Coulter, you know, that now she wants just start profiling that every Muslim, every Arab, everyone who is not an American, a white American, should be put in a line, completely frisked, completely strip searched, go through everything to make sure that they don't have a bomb on them. And it blows my mind that
we have the
technology to go ahead and scan people to make sure everything's there, and then, you know, come down again later. I think we should be implementing that more than just doing these random searches how we're doing it now.
Right. I totally agree. I mean, I think most of it works. I appreciate the call. I want to make sure Andy. So thanks a lot. There was a counterterrorism expert on that Rachel had on last night who's written books on it, and his big thing was we spend a lot of time trying to figure out the next attack based on the last attack. And the truth is our money would be better spent on investigation and prevention as opposed to – I mean, obviously – having new technology, the puppers are a good thing. They should be everywhere. That they're less invasive, and you can totally – They're great. They pull, you know, they atomize the air around you so they can pull off little bits of, if you've got explosives on you, they can smell it. Basically, it's like basically a giant door shaped bomb sniffing dog, essentially. Those would have worked just fine in this situation had they had them. It's odd that if they did have one, that the one guy without the passport, no baggage, who paid in cash, managed to get through, Muslim name or not. Here's the thing, and my big problem with profiling is that they go on one thing. Well, by that estimation, if you follow Ann Coulter's lead, we'd have to frisk Muhammad Ali every time he went through an airport. That's absurd. That doesn't help any of us. They should be able to triangulate these things. So, anyways, this was supposed to be handled during Bush. Remember this? The Patriot Act was helping to line these things up so that if anybody tried to act out of line, they would spot them because of this nexus of necessary spying that we had to have, and it doesn't work. All right, let me go to Andy in Madison because this might dovetail directly into what he's talking about. How you doing, Andy?
Good morning, Hal. How are you?
I'm great.
Good. I just think it's kind of funny how these, you know, when these low-grade terrorist attacks like this bombers, they always seem to coincide with, you know, an
with a change in policy.
Yes.
An advance in policy, let's say. Let's say,
yeah.
Try and be as diplomatic as I can. Yeah.
And even in the Bush era, you know, they had the.
I would say,
you know,
especially in the Bush era.
The terrorist scale.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then they would move it up to orange and, you know, get everyone all.
Yeah, I wonder. You know what? I didn't. That you make an interesting point, because does anybody think. Did anybody hear anything about a raise in the terror threat level? Did we go to. Magenta or anything like that? Did we go to puce? Because there was no shift in, there was no pucing this time around. That's kind of interesting, isn't that? In that, you know, because during the Bush administration, they would have jacked that thing up for the next 30 days,
sure,
and made everybody run around in circles instead of just calling, you know, all the appropriate agencies and going, okay, raise your own internal threat level. We don't need to have a big temperature, like a thermometer of fear that's playing in the background, you know, that when you walk into the airport, oh, that's how scared I need to be. Oh, good, good. Yeah. I wasn't aware of how afraid I needed to be while I was flying. So I had a yellow level of fear, and I should have an orange level of fear. I hadn't realized. And it's
actually Michael Moore was in the airport in
right. I saw him tweeting about it. I actually tweeted him back to tell him what was going on. He responded to me.
Oh, I'll be darned.
Yeah.
What did he say?
He was just, you know, he goes, it's amazing how little you know when you're actually there. You guys all know more than me. And so I immediately said, there's a, you know, apparently there's a second guy who locked himself in the bathroom of another flight. And that's why the machine guns, which, by the way, worst tool for that job. If you've got an if you've got a guy who's suspected of having a bomb on a plane full of innocent people, machine gun is not the tool. Handgun, yes. Rifle, perhaps. But the idea of going into a tube full of people, you know, with a machine gun is just insane. Like, how do you not hit everybody else?
Right.
Like, I get that it's macho. I really do. But like, there's a certain – we just should start carrying, like, at a certain point, SWAT is like, you guys stay outside. There's only – you know, we know exactly what's going on. We've been radioing – we've been on the radio with the plane for the last hour. We know who's there. And
well, that must have explained the White House limousine out in front, you know, waiting to pick up the terrorist to
right.
take him to his hotel.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate the call. Thanks so much, Andy. And do we have enough time? We got one more caller you think we can fit him in? Yeah, we got 2 minutes. Okay, let me get to Al and Gary. Al, are you there?
Yes. I just heard Ann Coulter's name mentioned.
I'm sorry about that. I apologize. That was my fault. I let that happen.
You know, I think it's pretty hypocritical. A good place to start with...
isn't that the name of her third book? Her autobiography? Pretty hypocritical? Pretty in quotes? I'm kidding. She's fine. All right.
I think she's hypocrisy personified, but you know, the point I'm thinking about is that, you know, to single out Muslim people like mm-hmm. that, I think the best place to start would be that during 9/11, which the Bush administration kept us safe on 9/10, by the way, they need to take responsibility for how safe we were on 9/10.
Oh, by no means. According to, do we have the Marley Matlin quote real quick? Is that in there? Can we pull that up real quick? Because if we can't, I'll play it for you in the next hour. But apparently, listen to this.
I was there. We inherited a recession from President Clinton, and we inherited the most tragic attack on our own soil in our nation's history.
Right. So Mary Matlin says apparently the plane left before the 2000 election, was in the air all during the recount, and landed after Bush had been in office for 10 months.
Yeah, when Richard Clark, you know, sent the information to the Bush administration about potential terrorism on our flights, on, you know, before 9/10, they kept us safe then, but they don't want to take, you know, responsibility for that.
Sure, guarantee this is all Obama's fault. That this didn't happen, right? We got
also,
I got. I'm up against a heartbreak. I appreciate the call. I gotta go. Excellent points. 1-800-STEF-12 is our number. I'm gonna get back to the calls after this. But I also want to talk a little bit more about Iran. And one of the reasons why we're not as safe as we could be in this country because of TSA is Jim DeMint to blame. I'm Hal Sparks. 1-800-STEF-12 on the Stephanie Miller Show.
and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. Now, I want to get to some of our calls. I'll actually get to these right away, because we've been talking this morning about sort of the backstory behind the underwear bomber. I was almost said Christmas bomber, but I don't want to do that at all. I don't want to. I will not, because then it almost has a war on Christmas connotation, and I will not play into O'Reilly's game. I will not do that. by the way, I don't know if I qualified as having a war on Christmas this year, because I'm not, since I'm not Christian, I'm actually not effectively, you know, technically Christian in any way, shape, or form, although I find them lovely people. I don't actually celebrate Christmas as such, so I had everybody over to my house. I had all the L.A. orphans, all my friends who couldn't fly back east either for lack of money or lack of time. Or a lack of a family worth being around during the holidays. They all stayed over my place, and we unwrapped presents, and we went and saw Avatar, which I think is the duty of every progressive liberal right now as far as movie money goes. And then, of course, we went and had Chinese food at the best Chinese food restaurant in L.A. And which I think is, that's as far as I'm going to go in the war on Christmas. I will not go so far as to use the name Christmas bomber for this idiot underwear bomber guy, who was apparently helped onto the plane by an undisclosed, quote-unquote, Indian man who we have never found, and had material support in Yemen, a place, by the way, that we have been helping the Yemeni government, which is a little I don't know if I'd call them a fully functioning government. They're a little lapscattered. They're, you know, we've been helping them bomb Al-Qaeda outposts and hideouts in their country for the last month, sort of covertly, and this was probably direct retaliation for that thing, which either means we missed or we didn't. You know, that's the hard part. We can't really tell, but we may be making progress because we're scaring them into actually acting out. And now, again, this is the issue we've been dealing with all along. So, but before I do this, I have to remember, Tony, this hour of the Stephanie Miller Show is brought to you by Saturn. The sale from Saturn is here. The best deal ever on Saturn, with $4,000 total cash back on every new vehicle, or qualified buyers can choose 0% financing on all models. Length of contract limited. Take delivery by January 4th. Hurry to your Saturn retailer today. You know, see, I actually, this is my first real radio duty, besides just kind of talking my head off. So, the question is, we've got a couple of callers on this who want to talk about the terror level, and I think this is a great topic. I want to hold on to you guys for 1 second, but I do want to get to this idea that the right is really pushing that this is Obama's fault and we're to blame and blah, blah, blah. But meanwhile, 9/11 was Clinton's fault. So apparently the blame game is in full force with these guys. The other thing, too, is that anytime we're trying to do something covert mixed with diplomacy, they would much rather we just kind of open fire and have a big shock and awe thing so that they can kind of get aroused at the whole process and go back to their nap. Do we have the Bolton quote? This is so right now in Iran, the protests are ramping up again to a level that's even higher in a lot of cases than the stuff we were following around the election when we were all captivated about what was going on in the street. If you go online, there's actually footage on YouTube that they've been uploading where protesters have actually circled riot cops up against the wall, have been beating them with their own clubs, and in some cases they circle them, don't hurt them, but then make them call the Grand Ayatollah a bastard. That's what they're making them. And they film it. They hold the thing, go, hey, call him a bastard. We're gonna beat the snot out of you. And so you've got, and it's a huge movement. People are actually saying right now that it is very possible that this could be the end of the mullahs, and this is a pivotal shift in Iran going on right now. This is genuine, you know, like self-directed democratic or free, you know, free men pushing for their own rights and privileges. And what is the right wing's response? John Bolton, this was his idea.
I think a careful campaign of public diplomacy in the wake of a military strike could explain to the people of Iran who are knowledgeable and sophisticated that the attack's not aimed against them. It's aimed against this regime that they dislike so much.
Sure. So if we sorry if we blew up some of your kids while you were trying to raid buildings and do the stuff that you do when you're trying to take over your own government. Sorry we blew up those places with you in them. But you know what? We'll run some ads. That's what we'll do. The diplomacy he's talking about is actually propaganda, because that's actually how they do it. It's absurd. So this is the right wing kind of direction. This is what they, you know, this is their plan. If you look at Lieberman's ideas, his quote was the weirdest. He goes, I was talking to a member of our government in the capital of Yemen. He was saying, Iraq is yesterday's war, Afghanistan is today's war, and Yemen is tomorrow's war. Yeah, okay, great. If that's your ideas, constant war, sure. That's a great idea. How about it's not? How about it's a police action that we're actually involved with giving aid to a government that's trying to quell psychos within their borders, as opposed to just opening up another war front on a type of enemy where there is no specific front. That's the, you know, using this, you know, using old war metaphors for a new kind of problem. But anyways, so why right now? Do we not have someone as a head of the TSA in this country right now? There is no one running the TSA. There's no administrator for the Transportation Security Administration currently. Why not? Because Obama has he's actually offered somebody up that he would like to have, but Senator Jim DeMint, Republican of South Carolina. You know that lovely state. He's actually put a hold on Obama's nomination for the administrator of the TSA. Yeah. And he's had that hold for quite some time. And his big problem with it is that he's worried that the person that Obama wants would help them unionize. Now, what's the negative about unionizing? Well, if they had a union, they could collectively bargain. They could get rights that would drive the cost of having them up a tad. Okay. The downside, how about nobody has any job loyalty in a situation where loyalty is everything? How about that? How about you get people in a situation where they don't have health insurance, they don't have, they're not covered, you know, they don't have a living wage in some cases, or they're overworked, or they have, you know, horrible hours, and somebody comes along and offers them, you know, $1,000 to look the other way so some drugs can come in. Then the second time, here's another $1,000 so some drugs can come in. Then the third time, they think it's drugs and it's really a bomb. How about that? How about the reason you unionize people is because it's partly the union's responsibility. Now you not only have the TSA is responsible for the behavior of these people, you also have the union who has to breathe down their throat to make sure that they, you know, breathe down their neck so that they know that that their contract is safe, so they don't want any bad apples and they don't want to feel like they've done. Anyways, so Jim DeMint, by the way, who's a member of the family, that lovely Christian organization who was behind the U.S. push for the Ugandan war on gay people that they all had to denounce because they got caught with their pants down again. Same people, by the way, who voted against Al Franken's anti-rape amendment that eventually made its way into the defense appropriations bill so that we don't do business with people who it's not even – you can't rape your employees. You're still allowed to rape your employees and put them in a boxcar and leave them there overnight with no food and no medical attention. You can still do that. You just you have to just let them sue you. That was the hanging point, was that these guys are so against anybody being able to be redressed for grievances that a woman who was gang raped and put in a shipping container overnight couldn't sue her company because of the laws were in place. They had a situation where I don't know, absurd. So we decided, Al Franken thought it'd be a good idea that we not do business with companies that are like that. And ta-da, Jim DeMint was one of the people who was against it. So, but he also doesn't want them to unionize. They've also been fighting off everybody who's complaining that, you know, Obama's not making more progressive advances. One of the big reasons is because the Senate has been rebuffing most of his more progressive nominations. A few of them have confirmed 30 of President Obama's nominees for federal posts, including head administrators for the U.S. Agency for International Development, National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, those kind of things. But the Senate rebuffed six other nominations. This is on Think Progress. It's an article by Faiz Shakir. Let's see. But the Senate also rebuffed six other nominations, including Office of Legal Counsel nominee Don Johnson. Dawn, by the way, female woman, not Don Johnson. At no point did Barack Obama suggest that Crockett, never did Obama suggest that Crockett should be running the Office of Legal Counsel, although they would be a lot more stylish. But they would probably freeze because it's in D.C. You can't wear a linen suit. It's terrible right now. Okay. And they also rebuffed Department of Labor's solicitor Patricia Smith, both of whom tout solid progressive credentials, as the Washington Post reports. The Senate did not take a formal vote Thursday on any of the officials, but Jim Manley, a spokesman for Senate Majority Harry Reid, said they ran into opposition. The criticism for Don Johnson came from John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, for lacking, quote-unquote, the seriousness and necessary resolve to address the national security challenges we face. Now, why would he think that she doesn't have the resolve, interesting choice of words, and the seriousness to address the national security challenges we face? That's because she was one of the people who was against the use of torture and wanted to look into it. This is really what it's about. This is, they don't want her anywhere near the ability to look into these things. And everybody's complaining that the Obama administration isn't going after the Bush officials. One of the reasons is because when they try to put somebody in place who will do just that very thing, they start getting rebuffed. This is where they run into opposition from the Senate committees and not being able to get their nomination through. And you can put an anonymous hold on somebody. You know, your constituents don't even need to know that you're putting a hold on someone. I'm sure Jim DeMint's constituents in South Carolina don't know that he put a hold on the head of the TSA. But anyways, so the other problem, Ben Nelson, Democrat of Nebraska, who's been a pain in the tuchus over a few things, is concerned about her outspoken pro-choice views. Is it the outspoken part or is it the views? Is she supposed to believe that but keep her mouth shut? Or is she supposed to say what you want her to say? This is clearly a problem. Either way, she's in the Office of Legal Counsel, and this is part of that incremental change that these guys have been pushing for a long time. That if we needed to co-opt anything, we need to co-opt the ability to look long term, because they are doing this. This is their way of chipping away at it. This is nothing. Nobody would notice Don Johnson not being added to the department, the Office of Legal Counsel per se. But it makes a huge difference down the line to not have her in place if you're trying to protect a woman's right to choose. And they know this, and the conservatives know this. And Ben Nelson, who has his buddies in that caucus, in that group, is protecting that for them. So, and then Senator Arlen Specter was my favorite. Arlen, I was a Republican, but now I'm a Democrat who votes largely Republican. He registered his opposition to Johnson without offering an explanation, probably because it never got out of his mouth because the Democrat and Republican parts of his brain were filibustering each other. That's my guess. So point I'm trying to make is that they've been stonewalling a lot of these folks, and it's one of the things that we get caught up in the healthcare bill. We get caught up in a lot of this stuff, and then we lose sight of these little changes, these little incremental changes that become much bigger later on. These are the things that calling your senator can help about, because these are little battles that they don't stake themselves on, but if they get some pushback, they actually would be able to do it. I'm just saying, pay a little more attention to that if you could. Think Progress always has great articles on that, and it's a great way to keep track of that. And obviously, we had Igor and Amanda from Think Progress on yesterday. We may have them back this week. So, anyways, I'm Hal Sparks. We're going to take a break. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller, 1-800-STEP-12. I'll get to your calls right after this. Streaming live on Ustream.tv, the Hal Sparks Hot and Sexy Cam Show. And, of course, you can watch me at HalSparks.com and join in our chat. And then, of course, you can listen to a little Zach Wilde as we go to break.
The following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Just sick. Breaking all the rules. It's Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. Well, that's what we're doing. Tony and I are breaking all the rules today. We're playing heavy metal. We're doing Conspiracy Corner when normally Jim has been relegated to, you know, a small area of the show and is not allowed to speak freely and openly. Jim, if you're listening by any chance, which you shouldn't be because you're supposed to be on vacation, call in and we will just totally nerd out on the conspiracy theory aspects of the underwear bomber. Who I again refuse to call the Christmas bomber. He will forever be, if Richard Reed or whatever his name was, is the, Reed Richards? No, that's from Fantastic Four. If the shoe bomber is the shoe bomber, then you have to be the underwear bomber, dude. That's how it works out. There's no, you don't, just cause you did it on Christmas Day, and cause it didn't actually go off too. So there you go. You know, you can't even be that unless you, you know. Anyways, point being, let me. I've only got a little bit before we need to take another break, but I want to get to. We got 2 minutes, so I want to go to Tony in Shreveport, Louisiana, because I've been there and it's a good place. How you doing, Tony?
Oh, dude, I'm doing great, man.
Great.
By the way, I've seen Avatar twice.
Yeah, isn't it great? I mean, I did you see it in 3D?
No. 3D makes my head hurt, so I mean, I had to watch it the old-fashioned way.
Well, this is, you know, it's interesting. People have complained about that, so you're probably right to do it. But go ahead.
My whole thing about the color scheme, mm-hmm. I never understood how it's supposed to make me feel safe. I mean, because if it's orange, am I supposed to be looking for a certain type of person? Right. I mean, why did they put that kind of information in my hands?
Well, obviously it was a manipulation tool used by the Bush administration to, you know, it was branding. It was really using terrorism and the fear factor as a way of, you know, as if it were a commercial, you know?
Yeah. And I totally understand it. I mean, because you can always tell when the first thing comes out of a public mouth is, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And it's so much harder for a Democrat to give a person hope when, you know, because I'm in Shreveport, Louisiana, but I consider myself a liberal,
right,
progressive, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
You know, I believe that the federal government should be in charge of the states, because if it was left up to the states, you know, I'd still be on the back of a bus and whatever with Jim Crow down here.
But, right. Totally. I mean, it's interesting. I'm up against a hard break, so I want to lose you, but I appreciate the call, and I think you make an excellent point about the color scheme was really a branding element. It was a straight up old fashioned commercial choice. It's almost as an ad agency came up with it. And I don't think it was ever effective as far as making people feel genuinely safer. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12. We'll be getting to your calls right after this. Follow me on Twitter at Hal Sparks. And we'll be back. Dio, filling in for the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm kidding. It's Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller while she's away on vacation. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We're talking about very serious issues, Tony. We can't just constantly just nerd out with 80s metal. Even though this is one of the weirdest lyrics in all of Rocked Up, where he goes, jump, jump. He just says jump twice at the end of a line. That's good. Is it jump on the tiger? Jump on the tiger! Yeah. You can see his stripes, but you know he's clean. I don't know what he's talking about, but I love it. I went and saw a Dio cover band, actually, and they were stunning. The dude was amazing. But, yeah. So, And how do I dovetail back into serious stories? That is very difficult. There's so much joy to be had in Ronnie James Dio. And by the way, we wish him well. He's actually battling stomach cancer, unfortunately, right now. And so our thoughts and well wishes go out to the lovely and talented Ronnie James Dio. And I use talented in the truest form and lovely in quotes because he's a funny-looking little dude. He looks like he should live under a bridge scaring billy goats. But he's awesome. It's the price, you know, you can't have a perfect voice and then have looks to go with it. It's just not rough. And so bless him. He just looks, because there's like 2 feet of space between each of his teeth. And, you know, and he looks like Klaus Meine's smaller, like dehydrated brother. So anyways, but that being said, amazing. Wish him well. That kind of thing. I want to go to some calls because people have been, Thomas in Columbia, Maryland. Is that you, Thomas? You there?
Yes, I am.
Excellent.
I wanted to talk about a couple items, and I think all of them are tied together.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about these holds, I don't think they should be allowed to be anonymous
right.
holds and things like that. But the one thing.
It's one of the most bizarre things. You know, one of the most bizarre elements of the Congress is the ability to do that kind of thing.
Right, I agree that's wrong. But the one thing is that no one, either Democrat or Republican, pays a price for all this obstructionism or all these games. If this situation had happened with the reverse, with the Republicans in charge, you know they would have held a press conference saying, our security is being held at
right.
risk because the Democrats are putting a hold on a TSA advisor. Because with the Democrats, they go, well, the Republicans are mean, and we can't
right.
say anything about it. Where's the political theater to hold these guys and shame them and say the Republicans obstruct every day is what they should be doing.
I'm afraid I'm it. You know what I mean?
But that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. And that's why with mm-hmm. the health care, some people think that this health care is a way to saying that public health systems will be weakened and we're going down a path of private health support systems forever. And that's why some people are nervous about what is coming out, as well as it being too expensive and not really doing anything about costs. This is attacking S-CHIP. So,
right. I totally agree. I think one of the missing parts of our strategy and unfortunately, like I said, this is what comes with at least in the Senate, what I would call like a false majority. This idea, because we have people like Ben Nelson and Mary Landrieu, and we got Joe Lieberman to contend with, and a couple others, that we are under the impression that we have a majority and we can march stuff through. And what's happening right now is you've got a lot of good Democrats presenting a lot of good legislation, a lot of good ideas, and they're being stonewalled by the few. And first of all, I think you're right on that any of the stonewalling should not be behind closed doors. It should be called out on it. And if they don't, I will. So one of the things we'll do.
I feel like the liberals seem like, you know, a bunch of pansies, and what the.
Well, it's because we have to. Because what we want to get done. Right. Well, what we want to get done actually requires a lot of work, and what they want to get done is all just fear tactic, rubber stampy kind of things. You know, it's much easier to create Guantanamo Bay than it is to get rid of it. It's much easier to pass a rule on, you know. Like strip away an ethical rule than it is to implement one. And so the work requires their votes in a lot of cases, so we have to end up playing nice with these idiots.
Well,
that's the shame.
You obviously follow things.
Yeah.
So you know a lot of what's going on, but that's because you do follow them.
Right.
I have no clue what the Democrats are about right now, unless you actively follow them. And I have no clue that the Republicans are doing all these holds and all these
right.
Filibusters. I mean, why is it that we don't know that?
I think there's a couple reasons. One is you got one network, MSNBC, that will actually present it with, I think, a modicum of truth in that area, and you've got Fox fighting it nonstop on the other side, and sort of CNN taking its lead from Fox as if it were Drudge, you know, that whatever they float, we just have to deal with it, whether we agree with it or not. And then on the other hand, you've got a messaging issue. You've got people. It's the kind of change that I think Obama is trying to implement, and I think the progressives are trying to put forth. there's no quick answer to it. There's no, it doesn't come very quickly. It's not sexy, and it's not bumper sticker type of, you know, legislation. So that we're up against that. So when we start to explain what's going on, people start to doze off. Their eyelids get heavy. Whereas if you just go, we're going to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here, people go, oh, yeah. And well, then they go back to watching CSI. You know, whereas if you go, what we're trying to do is ensure the $47 million we want to offer people who are in above 140% above the poverty level to be able to go into Medicaid, and then we want to expand SCHIP because it will cover this group of people, and people just, their heads hit the desk. And it's not because we're not doing good stuff, and it's not because people don't care. It's just because there's this disconnect, I think, in how, you know, we as Americans are used to getting our information. If it doesn't come in a short soundbite or a reality show type of setting, we're lost in that regard. So I think, you know, in the limited thing, we have progressive radio. Luckily, it's out there, and it's gaining ground. It's definitely growing. No matter what you hear on the other side, it's the reason they have to say it's going away is because it isn't. Air America has some great shows on it. Obviously, Progressive Talk in L.A. and San Francisco and Chicago, and it's spreading, and that's a good thing. Unfortunately, the part of being a progressive movement is that everything we're trying to push isn't normal, isn't what's, you know, politics as usual, isn't the mechanics of just kind of trickle down economics, these kind of things that have been around since Reagan, and we're trying to, you know, break them down and actually build something worth having. You have to almost be wonky just to be interested. You have to be a policy wonk just to dive in.
Well, can I just say one more thing? I think they could put out better messaging and hold press conferences if they want. And two, something very popular that the administration is tepid on is real Wall Street reform and bringing back Glass-Steagall because they have.
Sure. I'm a big fan of the. Absolutely.
It's popular and people know what that is and you can put the hammer down, but they won't because they have other considerations.
Well, they also have to fight for, you know, it's picking battles. That's the problem with this kind of, how our election cycles are set up. It's almost like a bear trap keeping people in office focused on that next election. Yeah, I was talking to Julian Wong from from American Progress, and he was discussing one of the reasons why China is able to implement as many policies as they are isn't necessarily because they have soldiers with guns on every corner. It's because a lot of their governmental officials don't have to worry about election every 2 to 6 years, and in our country it's 2, 4, and 6, so there's this big rotating thing. They don't have to worry about it, so they just kind of get on with the process of doing stuff. And ours, somebody's always up for a seat, and so somebody's always helping somebody who's up for a seat, even if theirs isn't. And it's this really difficult turnover. One of our big election reforms. One will be kind of a shift in money in politics. For one, we obviously campaign finance reform is a very important issue, and will come up again. It always does, but at some point it's got to hook. At some point we've got to the level of importance has to be there. There needs to be messaging work on that so people recognize how important it is. But secondly, we have to be involved as progressives. This idea that we can be involved with the Obama administration for 11 months, and then if we don't get what we want, I'm voting independent next time. I'm sick of this. I'm not getting what I want. I'm pulling out. That's exactly why we don't gain ground.
Well, one problem is Rahm has pretty much told us that we don't matter. So
that's I think he has his issues in what he's trying to get done, and I think he's playing the politics of the room, as is Harry Reid, to get the things that are big. You know, when you're trying to land a big fish, sometimes you lose the little ones over the side. And I think that's more what he's saying. I'm not a huge fan of Rahm Emanuel. And I think in the mix, he's a necessary evil. The thing I want to focus on is how much good is being gone. And don't let the Ben Nelsons of the world and the Rahm Emanuels let you lose sight of actually what we have accomplished this year. And I think that's part of the goal. The other side and Fox News and to some degree, CNN and that crowd part of what they want you to do is get so disenfranchised you'd check out, and so you don't think it matters to really push for progressive candidates. If anything, it's more important that we primary very progressive candidates and that we show up to vote and that we canvass again for them. It's this idea that we can somehow, we spent our wad on the Obama election, and now we're just kind of done, and if he doesn't fix it all, then I'm just going to go vote for Nader if he comes up again, is absurd. And that's one of the reasons why I think Rahm doesn't trust the left and doesn't, you know, feel like he can go to Obama like, they don't have your back, they're just going to gripe, and you're going to have to fight for the middle, which is what happened to Clinton. The left didn't have his back in the middle of the healthcare fight the way they should have, and in a lot of ways, you know, didn't come to his rescue during, you know, they just kind of allowed themselves to be embarrassed by his behavior in the second term. And we can't afford to do that. We have to double. If anything, you go, look, this is starting to matter to me. This matters more than ever now. I get it. We're this close. It is, you know, last year when we were like, all we got to do is get him in and then we're in. First of all, that's been true on a bunch of issues. But on our deeper, more contentious issues, we need more ammo. We need
to
more
feel
people.
That the guy is fighting for you and is standing for something and not just playing a double game, which is a sense that a lot of us have.
Well, but again, how are you going to get it done? You know, if you have to do give and take just to get the bill out of the Senate, for example, the health care debate, and this has come up a bunch. Is that and I think, are we up against a break? Should we take a break? Yeah.
Okay.
It's okay. The thing I want to do, and I appreciate the call before I go to break, is that I – well, you know what? I'm going to do with it. I'm going to talk about it after we get back because I want to have a little bit of time and I want to be able to get to a couple more calls. 1-800-STEF-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks filling in on The Stephanie Miller Show.
If you turn her on, she'll turn you on.
Oh, God.
It's The Stephanie Miller Show.
The Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks filling in. 1-800-STEF-12 is our number. I'm going to go to Sonny in Seattle, Washington. Sonny, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
How are you?
I'm good. So I've been meaning to call the progressives for a while now.
And do you consider yourself progressive, or are you obviously not?
I was actually a registered independent. I wasn't registered anything until the primaries. That's when I switched to become a Democrat.
Okay.
So the one thing I want to point out is it is not about fighting. Okay, it's about figuring out a way to fight. There is a right and wrong way to fight in any cause you want for.
Sure.
And first of all, you can't just vote and just go sit home.
Right.
Okay, which is what the Democrats do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they try to make this one person go over there and get everything you want done. It cannot happen that way.
Right.
Without an activated masses, an activated electorate, you can't get anything done. Today, there's an article about how the healthcare industry and the insurance industry are working with the Republicans to basically change the constitution in Florida to make sure whatever you pass in at the federal level doesn't make it all the way to Florida. Okay.
Right. Yeah, so, they're running, and that's in 12 other states.
Exactly.
As well.
14, actually. 14 is what they said. Okay, so there's 14 states now about to overturn whatever fight we're getting done in the federal government. Okay? So then here we are having progressive argue with each other. Fire Dog Lake. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Fighting the President of the United States.
Right.
There is a right and wrong way to fight. You can push him to push more progressive agenda.
Right.
But how is he going to get it done without
the progressives
staying involved, staying connected, and first of all, know what's going on, not just bickering, okay?
I think that's great. It's an excellent point, yeah.
Yeah, you vote and then you wait until everything turns over and then you start fighting late, too late for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the Republicans have been activated since the election was over.
Yeah.
And we all voted him in, and then we all went home and enjoyed ourselves and waited for magic to happen. It doesn't work that way.
Right. Well, yeah, I think I that's exactly right. I think one of the things that we learned about the Obama election was the power of engagement, the power of actually getting out there, that we actually made this happen. The first African-American president, a stunning shift in the country after 8 years of Bush. Clearly progressive ties, I think, and a pragmatic approach, a long view, you know, not necessarily, the reason why they focus on what a great speech giver he is because he doesn't speak in sound bites. He actually engages the concept as well. His speech on race, his speech, quite frankly, at when he received his Nobel Peace Prize, that the right actually applauded, let's not forget. Now the work begins. And I even said that. He has, A, it's not about me, and B, now the work begins. And that's true. And he didn't, by work, he didn't mean, you know, watching the news on a fairly regular basis and making an occasional phone call. If we want to make real changes in this country, we want to make it the great country it could be, which it currently is not. And I will, I'm fine with some, redneck in a suit on Fox News calling me out on that, I suppose, because I happen to think one of the best things about that you want to do is criticize your country for the best in the same way that you would criticize yourself if you're not living up to your own standards. You know, I don't lose any love on myself if I go, I'm not eating right, or I'm not exercising enough, or I'm not acting in a way that's in line with my own personal ethics. That's the power of self-correction in a lot of ways. And as a body politic, that's our responsibility. But this idea that, first of all, A, I don't buy it. I think there's a lot of progressives out there and a lot of people in the middle and independents who know that the difference between Obama and McCain was way more stark than even than the media portrayed it, especially once he added Palin to the ticket. And I think they take it a lot more seriously. And I look forward to the day when we as a people have almost kind of a BBC relationship with our own news, where we want a depth of information as opposed to just give me the cliff notes and let me go on with my, in line at Starbucks. I think we're actually growing up as a public. At least I hope so. But you cannot have this situation where, people are, like I said, I don't buy it. I think a lot of people who call in and say, I used to vote for him and I'm not going to anymore because this is crap. And I think that's a lot of sales talk from the other side, quite frankly. But the ones who are like that and who do rally around that idea, you have to start asking yourself, do you deserve the government you want? In the same way that if you're on an exercise program and you balk at how the first meal tastes, this, I don't like the taste of broccoli. I wish this was pizza. Well, sorry, dude. You want to be healthy or not? This is the issue. That I think is how we need to start thinking. This is how we need to play long game here, and we need to, anytime somebody brings up, I don't think that's crap, nothing's happening, and they use this hyperbolic language, this over the top. I mean, I've heard bunches of people do it. The guy filling in for Bill Press actually is doing a lot of this, just like, and then I'm just betrayed by the whole thing is a mess and nothing's happening and blah 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 blah, which is absurd. A lot of stuff is happening. If a couple of your pet projects aren't happening, that doesn't mean that the rest of it isn't solid work. And to call it and act as if that's true does a disservice not only to your party and to your own principles, but also to your message, because I start to take you a lot less seriously. If you go, no, Obama's not doing anything he promised. Well, that's crap, because he's doing a lot of what he's promised. If he's not getting a couple of things through because we've got people like Ben Nelson and Joe Lieberman running interference against it, then our responsibility is to make those blockers get out of the way. If we're really in the game, if we actually care about this stuff, that's how you react. You don't just kind of give, seventh inning, it looks like they're behind by too many points. I'm not interested anymore. I'm going to pack up and go home. We hate those fans when we see them at a game, don't you? Did you hate the people who are like, yeah, you just leave, and you're like, dude, stay. There's four innings left, and you're just trying to get out of your parking space. This is lame. That's where a lot of people who call in and say, or I hear on the news pretending at least to call in and say, I was with them, but now this is a total betrayal. Guantanamo didn't shut and quick enough for me, even though he ordered it. Because it hasn't shut down immediately, he's a liar. That's absurd. He put 30,000 new troops in after reviewing it for 3 months. I don't trust him anymore, even though we know he thinks, even though we know he cares, even though we know he's paying more attention than the last president by an astronomical factor. Okay. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. We'll be back right after this. 1-800-STEPH-12.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. Hi, how are you? Good morning. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number, stephaniemiller.com. And, of course, this hour of the Stephanie Miller Show is brought to you by Saturn. The sale from Saturn is here. The best deals ever on a Saturn. With $4,000 total cash back on every new vehicle, or qualified buyers can choose 0% financing on all models. Length of contract limited. Take delivery by January 4th. Hurry to your Saturn retailer today. That means you have to get there this weekend and really, you know, give it a go. Give it a show. So, yes, there we did. See, Tony, we did the business. We actually, you know, I think I just sold a Saturn. I feel good about that prospect. That's good. So we've been talking all morning about Republican obstructionism and how one of the reasons why we're all a lot less safe and why we don't have someone to head the Transportation Safety Administration is because Jim DeMint of the family fame has been blocking President Obama's nomination to head that, and along with a lot of other progressive nominees that Obama's put for a lot of different areas, including and I think this is one of those things we should kind of balk about, because they might revisit it, because they've actually gotten a little bit of mail about this. It would be lovely if people would contact their senator and ask them if they opposed Dawn Johnson for the Office of Legal Counsel and why she didn't get through. And I'd like to see a little bit of blowback on that. That would be really cool. I think they're not expecting it. And I think it's one of those areas where these little important battles can be lost and we don't pay attention to them because we're all caught up in this big, crazy healthcare debacle. And then, of course, the underpants bomber has drawn its way. But I want to get to some callers in the very beginning of this, because we've got a lot of people here, and I think it's fantastic. And so let's go to Deuce. I want to go to Deuce in a second, but I want to go to Rick in Alberta, who's been holding the longest. Rick, you there?
Yes, hi.
Hiya.
Hi, Al. Not just to explode a few right-wing heads, but don't you have something called a recess appointment that the president could use for something like this? Wouldn't that be good timing?
Indeed. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of blowback about that during the during the Bush administration from our side. It would be interesting to see if they would balk at that. A lot of them, I think that, and I'll have to look into this, but I think the anonymous holds beforehand may preclude that. But that, you know, it's weird parliamentary procedure, I think. It's peculiar. I'm for it. I'm absolutely for it. I think in a lot of ways he's catching enough heat from, you know, the stuff he's doing overtly. You know, and they're not making any friends trying to get this, you know, get the health care bill through. And I think push, you know, the more progressive side of it in the House, and hopefully in committee get that through in this, so that if they made more enemies in the Senate, it's still got to go back there for a vote. You know, it's still got to reach that 60-vote, majority again to beat the filibuster that Lieberman has said he will do, and others have insisted that they will actually filibuster the health care bill. So it might be that he feels like
shine light on things too.
Shine light
on the obstructionism.
Oh, believe me, I'm a fan. If they actually had to stand there and do this for real, if they had to filibuster for real instead of going, I'm filibustering from where my office. Call me when I'm done.
Yeah, make them pee down their legs.
Exactly. They should have a catheter and a little flask on their leg, like Burt Reynolds in The End.
Exactly. Right. Well, no, you need equal time for Smith Goes Washington, A Wonderful Life.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. And I'm obviously a big fan of your country. I spent a good deal of time in Toronto, and I got to say, they do a lot of things right up there, and I think we get sold a bill of goods about them on occasion. Okay, so Deuce in Austin, Texas. Only in Austin, Texas can you have a name like Deuce and just get away with it. How are you?
I'm good.
Were you
I'm
named after the Kiss song or the card? Or
No, it's a nickname.
Okay, cool.
I'm calling about the spanking the progressives.
Yes, okay.
I think that if you think that progressives didn't work for the health care bill, I think that you weren't paying attention.
I don't think they didn't work for the health care bill.
The progressive movement that got the liberal reps in the House to demand a public option. Mm-hmm. Obama never supported the public option. He never came out and fought for it. He gave it lip service, but he never pushed for it, and everybody knew that.
Right, and I think I think that was actually part of the plan. I don't think that was an accident. I don't think it was the abdication of that. I think he always set a very clear goal that the whole point was to make sure that everybody could be covered and people couldn't be kicked off. And if that was the way, if that was, you know, if the public option was the best way to do that, he was for it. But if it wasn't, then he'd love to hear a better version. Now that was, and that was where people were saying he was soft on the public option in that regard. The other thing too was the right was waiting for him to just hang his hat on the public option so that if they could kill it, it would hand them a huge victory. You know?
Well, it's dead, and you have people who mobilized for the first time, not including myself, but others who voted for Obama, who now feel like, well, what's the point? Because mm-hmm. nothing's going to change. If he had fought for it and lost, I think that there would be a better feeling about it. There would be a better feeling about him.
Well, that may be true. That may be true on our side. We're almost used to going down in flames. You know, but the whole point is to actually get these changes implemented. Now,
the change that's implemented is a very poor change, or that is likely to be implemented. It's very poor, and I have trouble.
Well, I disagree because I think the House bill is worth being there, and if we would lose everything in the House bill because we blew up the Senate bill, I think that's a huge loss. And all we do is go back to zero. We've been at zero. We've never been this close to even the positive reforms we're talking about, like Medicare being expanded possibly to cover people 55 and up. That's still in the House bill. That's still a strong possibility and could make it out of committee if we can keep people from filibustering it. If we can actually get it through with 51 votes after, you know, if we have to pull reconciliation to do it, this is what we should be fighting for instead of I'm out. That's the problem I have. It's not that people aren't fighting. It's that this feeling like I did my part and now I'm done and I don't trust the process because of what actually goes on. It speaks to sort of an infantile kind of a nature, and I think it's not helping us in any way. Here's what I'm suggesting is that there was definitely a strategy to get this bill out of the Senate and into committee so we could actually get the two bills together, and that the House, because it does hold some purse strings that the Senate has to deal with, will actually get them to allow some of the more progressive elements in. Then there are windows in this bill that allow us in the future to create a strong public option or expand Medicare, these kind of things, if and when we pass this bill. If we don't, that goes away. We go right back. We might as well be in the middle of the Bush years. And then going into an election, we don't get anything done. And then and then trying to redress this, let's say we maintain our majority, which I actually think we will do. We will still, they'll still be running interference because at that point they'll have nothing to lose. And so you'll have these, more of these anonymous holds, more of these filibusters. The important thing is that the bill allows us to expand on it. This is even more important than whether or not it has the public option in it. Because the public option that they had in the Senate bill initially, everybody's complaining was watered down and actually was ineffective and was a giveaway to regardless. So we would have gotten it in name only. That's not what I'm interested in. And I think the House bill has so many good things in it that I'm not willing to shoot the hostage in this situation because of the Senate compromises. And I think what we have to do is we got to put this together. And before we start saying Obama threw the baby out with the bathwater, this is a total betrayal, I think it's, you know, unfair and it's not what I voted for and it's not what I'm getting or whatever, we should actually see the bill that's signed. And I think we got to pay attention to the process. We have to drive it. We have to be active progressives. We have to ask for what we want. We have to drive our politicians that way. But we can't just play the blame game, drop out, and say, well, the Republicans always seem to win, and we supposedly have a majority, so this should be an easy win. It's not. We've got 60 votes in the Senate. That's great. Two of them include people like Ben Nelson and Joe Lieberman.
Hal?
Yes.
I think it's important that progressives stop blaming progressives for problems.
I don't think I'm blaming progressives for the problem.
People were opting out. People had voted and went home, mm-hmm. and that is not the case. And I think that
that's not the case with you, and I appreciate that.
Please don't
get offended on criticisms that are actually not aimed at you. We tend to do this on the left a lot. We tend to get upset because we share a label with someone else that we also share the same culpability if they don't live up to their own standards.
You're not helping the progressive movement by saying that progressives aren't fighting, because they are.
I'm not saying they're not fighting. I never said they're not fighting. I'm just I'm worried that the people I was actually addressing the ones who aren't fighting, the one who aren't actually involved in the fight, the ones who are going, I voted and I canvassed and that's it. And I think the word fighting is actually is the wrong word for it. And I think that's somebody just pointed out in the chat room. By the way, we're streaming live on Ustream. I appreciate what you're trying to say. I'm trying not to paint with too broad a brush, by the way. I'm not saying the left. I'm not saying progressives. I'm not saying liberals. I say we when we have challenges together. But I'm not at all suggesting that progressives shouldn't or don't fight don't work towards getting the changes that they want really aggressively. My issue is this nihilistic, this kind of slacker, I'm done, dude. This is crap. I don't know. It's absurd. And to say that that's me attacking progressives who are trying to make some progress is a little ridiculous. I want to go to, I go to Faith in Gainesville. Faith, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Hal. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great.
I almost hung up because the lady before me was, like, way more articulate than I usually am.
But well, I'll be the judge of that. You seem lovely.
Oh, well, thank you very much. But I'm afraid I'm some of your stupid progressive people.
Okay.
And it's not – I'm not even going to talk about issue by issue by issue, because that just is a circular firing squad there. But here's where my problem came in. Obama did not give us one progressive in his cabinet, in his inner circle, nothing. It would have killed them to give Dennis Kucinich the Department of Peace. Second, we're not even getting lip service from him. He is giving lip service to every other political group out there, and he's not even giving us what you're saying. If President Obama came out and he said, listen, this is our long game, this is what we have to do, I'd be a little more inclined to still be on his side. But he's had more meetings with Republicans and corporatists and bankers and all their cronies than he has with any major progressive organization.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. I know you do, but I would like to address the first three because they're basically hyperbolic and not true. And I think it's important
so
that you know that. I mean,
that you don't agree with him.
No,
I'm hyperbolic.
No, I mean you're speaking in such a broad. You're saying he's not giving even lip service to us. You're using very broad language, and then I can't just let that sit. If you're going to say he hasn't given us even lip service, then the entire shift in our policy in engagement in the Middle East, Afghan, including even the Afghan escalation, if you want to call it that, have all been a shift in how we deal with our diplomacy with other countries, the signing of the Lilly Ledbetter Act, the Sonia Sotomayor none of these count to you. Okay, that's fine. So what I'm saying is these are actual changes. These are actually things that have happened.
Yippee!
Okay, so you don't, that those don't concern you at all.
I'm getting a little,
Getting a little what?
You just get me so fired. Bottom line for me, Hal, is that the progressives who feel like I do,
uh-huh.
who think like I do,
uh-huh.
I think it would be important for someone to pay attention to the fact that we're even out here.
Okay,
I like to call it Obama deficit disorder. We're kind of like the lady from Fatal Attraction.
Yeah, you won't be ignored, so you're going to boil the rabbit? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
right. She was nuts and of no good to anyone. So I don't know that that's necessarily an analogy you want to use for yourself. We got to take a break. we do, as we're up against it. But I'm sure there are more people out there like her. I'm not sure if we have to care. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for the Stephanie Miller Show. We'll be right back after this.
Your girlfriend was a freak like her. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. We're in our last half hour of the show already. Man, just blazes by. We've been streaming live on Ustream.tv, the Hal Sparks Hot and Sexy Cam Show. And, of course, you can follow me in the chat room there on Twitter, at Hal Sparks. And you can go to halsparks.com. It actually also streams from there as well. But if you do the Ustream, I'm glad to have you on there. There's been some miscommunication or people are listening to little bits and not the whole thing, thinking that somehow I think that progressives shouldn't fight for what they want, when the whole time I've been saying fight for what you want, but don't kick out of the game. You know, I don't take your ball and go home. And that's the attitude that I'm trying to fight the most. It's engagement we always need. But there seems to be this idea that if we don't get what we want right away, or if it doesn't come in the exact package that we want, or if they try to, God forbid, if the Dems try to sneak it through the process and without the Republicans getting wind of what's actually going on in the bill and kind of making this... You know, one of the things that was floated in the healthcare bill, and hopefully we'll make it through committee if the public option isn't in there, is this idea that there will be government-regulated nonprofits in the exchange that will be overseen by Health and Human Services, which would basically be a public option. But if you call it that, then they know to attack it and try to take it out in committee. So it's in there, it's floating through, and then here, you know, people are jumping on it going, this is not exactly that, so we should, can we at least, how about if fight for the public option to stay in there, but leave that clause in there in case it gets tossed out, but why fight the good parts of it just because they're not 100% of what it, that's the part that drives me crazy. And why disengage based on some sort of fabricated idea of betrayal, and go where, and do what? I mean, I don't buy the lesser of two evils thing. I've said this before, but between a pickpocket and a serial killer, the pickpocket is the lesser of two evils, but the drop off is really huge. And if both of them wanted to spend the night in your house, you wouldn't flip a coin to make the decision. It's a very easy decision because one of them might or might not steal something and the other one will have sex with your corpse. We have to recognize the difference between the two of these. I've only got 1 minute before I have to take a break again, but I'm going to get to these calls at the bottom of the hour because I really do want to talk to these guys. It's a fantastic conversation. It needs to be had. I am not trying to get people to disengage from this. If anything, I want you to engage more. I want you more involved, and I want you engaged in the long term. You know, when people say, I'm not even going to vote next time, then I have no interest in your impotent anger. Then you're just saying I'm not in it. I don't care enough about my principles to even be engaged past a certain point. It's silly. It's counterintuitive. It's disingenuous. And I don't believe you. I don't think you're really a progressive if that's how you live, because obviously the principles don't matter enough to you. I'm Hal Sparks. Other than that, I have no opinion. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12. We'll be right back after these messages. Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. We're in the bottom half of our last hour on the show today. It's a fascinating discussion we're having. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I want to take a bunch of these calls because a lot of these people have been waiting quite a long time. Let's see. Jonathan is a big advocate of single payer. Jonathan, you're in Puerto Rico.
Yes, I am, because I listen to the Stephanie Miller Show wherever I go.
Right on.
So I was listening to your discussion this morning, and I just wanted to put in a few key points.
Great.
First things first, as progressives, we need to stop being babies, right? Mm-hmm. And we need to go ahead, and if we have an issue with a certain aspect of policy, we need to figure out who opposes it. And whenever they run up for re-election, an example, Blanche Lincoln or
right.
Ben Nelson,
yes.
they need to go ahead and support a progressive candidate.
Exactly.
In that state.
And so, hardcore, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally believe that. Second of all, I think Obama's trying his best, but he's doing the best with what he has.
Right.
So what I would hope to see, what I think he should do, is that instead of doing all this reform type of stuff that doesn't need reconciliation, he should use, and this is my view,
okay.
he should pass a public option and make it the gold standard. It's the gold standard, so everyone will flock to it. Whenever
mm-hmm.
I work at a pharmacy, so whenever I see someone come in paying 50, 60 bucks for just a generic for a medication,
right.
if they paid less than that under a public option, they would flock to it.
No, yeah, no question.
It's the same thing that FDR did when he set up these power companies to compete with private ones. Everyone flocked to them
right.
because they just made more common sense.
I totally agree. I think that's exactly why the Republicans and the conservative Dems are fighting it, because they know how popular it would be.
Yeah, but I think that at the same time, what President Obama needs to do is to, you know, I know he wants to pass reform, which is great, but I think that it would be reform itself if he just created a public option, which would be the gold standard. And my third point is, I know that some progressives see that Obama has many challenges and he has to meet them. An example, he has to reduce the deficit. He has to do a lot of things because he's going to get hammered come election time. I think he can do it.
I do too.
I think to help him out.
I appreciate the call too.
Yeah.
I think there will be a shift in the deficit. Obviously, the economy is turning around. Jobs are always the lagging indicator, and it's going to be tough for the next year, no question. But there is a shift in the economy that's coming back. There might be a mild contraction in the spring, according to Paul Krugman. But we're out of the woods in that regard. Which I think, by the way, was a manufactured woods that we were forced into. I don't think obviously I have my issues with how our economy was based on, you know, a house of cards in a couple of areas that were always jittery. But this particular recession and the timing of it, I don't think was any kind of an accident. I think that the people who were in charge when it went down thought it would help their side if they just allowed stuff to go through, and it would hurt the progressive side, and it would also leave us in a situation where we don't have any money to pay for anything. That's one of the arguments that they've been using, that if he has to drive the deficit up just to get us out of, keep us from going into a depression, you know, then he's not going to be able to spend it on social programs. I mean, that's been a ploy for a very long time. So anyways, regardless, I personally think that we have a responsibility as progressives to go, if we don't like something, we're going to make sure that if you don't think Obama's progressive enough, surround him with more progressives. But don't lose any, don't even harbor the momentary illusion that somehow that not voting next time is actually a choice, and that allowing anybody who would do this, like McCain and Palin types in office, actually having to, you know, actually having them in office, that's actually any kind of a responsible, you know, reaction to the healthcare bill not having a public option in it as it comes out of the Senate before it goes into committee. It's just not you're not really having a conversation. You're just yelling for the purpose of saying it, and you feel bad, so you want to act out on it. It's silly. So, I want to go to Steve in Bellingham, Washington, because he wanted to talk a little bit about, I guess, finance reform. I can't read fully what it says, but you there, Steve?
Oh, yeah, Hal. I'm enjoying the show.
Thanks.
Yeah, well, you mentioned earlier, you said that one advantage that China has over our democracy is that they're not always trying to get reelected over there.
Right.
And that's true. But, you know, that problem can be easily fixed with a publicly financed campaign.
Right.
So that our politicians are not constantly every day having to raise money. But also something else that's very
important. There'd still be an element of sales that they have to do fairly regularly, where that even if the state was paying for it, they'd have to spend a year doing ads and you know, barnstorming their state to get their constituents to remember who they were.
But
I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
No, but that's just it. There's more. The thing is, the political season has gotten longer and longer. And in other countries,
this one started the day after Obama got in office.
Season. Yeah. And it used to be a very short season. It's very short in Europe. I don't know how they do it. You could make a law. That's a restriction on free speech, but there's lots of other restrictions on free speech, and you could make the campaign 6 weeks long or something like that, or 8 weeks long.
Right.
It'd be easy to do. It's much shorter in other countries. Here it's gotten longer and longer, mainly because it benefits the networks.
Well, you know what it's also done is it's gone the way we sell products in this country because of the amount of channels, the amount of input the average consumer has. If you look at, when the original Batman movie came out, the sprawl, that was one of the first ads that did sprawl for a year. They were doing, the emblem all over the city, and eventually it dragged out this one, you know, before that, movies, you knew a month before it came out, unless you read about it, that it was coming and you cared enough, but they started promoting it about the time they'd want you to think about going to see it. Now they do it a year out. You'll go to see a trailer to film for a movie that's not coming out for 2 years.
Well, that's true.
That's happened in all PR. I think everybody is thinking that way because of the total reach of all kinds of messaging, that they have to crack through that message to get it, which is why I think that there should be another, where you can, I think what I'm getting to is that I think your free speech analogy is good in that if you take the news, for example, and you enact some sort of, look, news has a responsibility to do a certain amount of public service, and every channel that, gets the, that rents the airwaves from the American people has a responsibility to put on a news channel that is objective.
Oh, yeah.
Based on facts and gives equal time to candidates and issues.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is that's something you can do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can shorten the political season. There's no reason why. I mean, people can talk, but they could restrict. I don't know how they'd do it.
I think that's one of the ways you do it is that you at least just guarantee a window of it. And the rest of us would just get used to not having it the rest of the year because we got lives to lead. I totally get you. I appreciate the call. How much time do we have in this one? Got a couple minutes? Yeah, yeah. Let me take one more call before that. Let's see. Let's see, where is he? Okay, let's Vince in Norfolk, Virginia.
Hey, Hal, look, I'm going to be very concise.
Sure.
Democrats suffer from poor message delivery. And the reason why is Democrat leaders are like high school teachers refusing to accept that they're teaching a fourth grade class. See, mm-hmm. Republicans, they do not tell their constituents to stop being babies. They don't tell them to stop crying. Instead, what they realize is that by attacking their constituents or admonishing them, all they do is they push them away.
Right.
Instead, they accept their lack of knowledge about the inner workings. Yes, and they focus on converting their constituents into cheerleaders by giving them a simple message and talking points. That is what we have to do. The reason why we won the election is because Obama did just that. Yes, we can.
It's true.
And we need to continue to do that, and we need some very creative people to do that.
Well, you mean that was a great message for our side, and I think you make a really excellent point. That was a great message for our side. The "Yes, we can" moniker, which he used, and I think it's a great motto to have in general as a body politic, as a people. But also, it equates to activity. "Yes, we can" requires doing something. It wasn't about being; it was about doing. It's what we can accomplish, not, yes, we are. The right tends to do a yes, we are. We're America. We're about freedom. But that doesn't require you to do anything. "Yes, we can" requires you to act.
Well, just real quick, I just want to address that. Is every caller that's calling in that says they don't understand what exactly they're saying is give us a talking point.
Right.
Give us security, and we will chant it. They don't know what to chant, so they're lost, and they have no comfort, but Republicans have point after point after point to chant. That's all they're asking.
Well, it's because they use the right. I agree. I think there's a structure that they use, and I got to take a break. But I appreciate the call so much. There's a structure that they use that's based on a religious hierarchy. It's always it's how you do corporate power. It's how you do monarchies, and it's how you do top down government and top down economics. And it does come. It's a well tried methodology. And that's the problem with our side, as it were, in that we don't have that automatic machinery. There's so many of us, and a lot of us have differing views, and we are meant to be respectful of those differing views. So the movement on our side is a lot more watery, and it takes a lot more activity than just marching orders. If you run something like a military, you gain the ability to act quickly and with singularity, but you also lose any sense of humanity in it. And I think the progressive movement is really trying to maintain our humanity while we achieve these changes. And we can't lose sight of that. And we tend to when we go, I'm out. So I'll be right back. This is not me saying I'm out, by the way. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We're going to get to some more of your calls when we get back. But this is an issue we all have to deal with. I want to share with you a quote you'll hear it after we come back. 1-800-STEP-12. It's Stephanie Miller.
It's not radio. It's Stephanie Miller.
Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph while she's away on vacation. I'm here today. Tomorrow's my last day, and then we're off for New Year's. Tony gets to get some sleep. Our board op, who's by the way, if you've been watching on Ustream, you actually get to see Tony on occasion. Where there he is. Hey, wave to him, Tony. So I think it's a great. Tony just needs rest. These are crazy hours, I have to admit. This is something I'm not used to as well, but I think it's important, and I love the conversation that we're having. Everybody in the chat room says hello to Tony, by the way. I think Tony's going to get a girlfriend out of this. I think so. Could happen. It happened. He's praying, but I think it could happen. I want to get to some calls because I haven't got much time left, but I really do want to deal with this. So let's go to Stuart in Seattle, Washington. Stuart, you there?
Yes. If anybody wants to stay home and not vote, they are doing exactly what the corporatocracy wants.
Right.
We need to vote the corporate Democrats out in the primaries. Everybody forgets that there are primaries.
Mm-hmm.
So first we need to fight the corporate Dems in the primaries and then vote for the best that we can.
Right.
The other half
and then follow up with them once they're in office.
Yes.
And be informed about it.
Mm-hmm. And the other half is we voted the best legislature and presidency that we could in years, and we got crap because those people don't run the show. The corporatocracy runs the show. We need to fight the puppeteers. We need to fight corporate power because those are the people that are pressuring our legislators, our president, to do what we don't want them to do.
Right.
And we need to fight the corporate propaganda media.
Yes, and there are overt ways to do that. And there are covert ways to do that. The overt ways to do that, of course, are supporting progressive candidates, working for campaign finance reform. These are things that issues have been on the table for a long time, and we can definitely fight for specific issues. The covert way we can do it is by in our own way of being, in our own as progressives, be a little more disciplined in how we speak of our own issues. Insist on a certain level of information in what we're talking about. Insist on like I said, playing the long game, insisting on a higher standard for ourselves, and sticking to it even when they go low. And they're going to. They're going to. You make an excellent point. By the way, people are in the chat room are really appreciate your call, Stuart. I want you to know that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate it. I'm going to go to Emma in Coleraine, Mass. Let's see. Where is she? She's four. There she is. Emma, hi.
Hi. Can you hear me all right? We're having terrible winds here, and my phone lines aren't great, but...
That's okay. You sound like you're in a tin can, but I hope that's not the case. It's kind of charming, though. Go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to thank you for helping us not be so impatient.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of progressives are a little too impatient. Like your last caller was saying, we have to vote in the primaries. We have to know our issues. We have to know what's the difference between what the Republicans and conservatives are trying to make it look like what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that occasionally we're getting callers who are actually shills.
Oh, absolutely.
The Republicans and the conservatives who are just trying to foment distrust.
And anxiety, right.
And anxiety and anger and all the rest and make us apathetic or make us just less supportive of our candidates.
I totally agree. I thank you for the call, Emma. That's a really good point. And hopefully you survived the wind.
Okay,
be careful. One of the things that the memes they float constantly is the lesser of two evils idea. And I spoke to that earlier or whatever. But that's one of those things. There's no difference between the parties now. There's really no difference between the parties. You know, well, who cares? Might as well just vote for the one that makes me feel safe because I'm scared right now. So I'll vote for the Republicans or I'll just not vote at all because there's no difference between the two of them. If there was no difference between the two of them, we wouldn't even be talking about Ben Nelson. We wouldn't even be talking about Joe Lieberman because the rest of the Dems would all be the same. We wouldn't have the single obstruction of individual senators wouldn't matter because they wouldn't be presenting any bills that actually had anything in them to begin with. The important thing is that we stay engaged, and the thing that they're going to try to drive you away from is the polls. And I'm going to find that quote that sometimes Tom Hartman plays, Tony. We're going to find that one with a conservative activist, one of the fathers of the conservative movement in the early 80s, who was one of Reagan's big supporters, who said the goal is to have people not vote. As few people vote as possible is their goal, and then control that vote as much as possible. And we have to remember that. Part of this, every time you hear somebody going, I'm out, you got to understand that that's part of an idea virus that's put out there to guarantee low turnout, to guarantee a removal from the process. So anyways, let me get one more. Let's see. We get in Chapel Hill. We've got Jay in Chapel Hill. Jay, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Real quick. This isn't the main reason I called, but essentially your message of telling voters just to suck it up and deal with what they are offered isn't really motivating people to get to the polls, just in reality. But the main reason I called is that when
well, there's not an election currently.
There will be in November 2010.
That's true.
And just telling people like, oh, this is a crappy bill, so just, you know, be happy with it and go.
I'm not just saying that. I'm saying that I said that Senate bill has some issues, and clearly we're not happy as progressives about it. But there's so much good stuff. Hold on. There's so much good stuff in the House bill, I'm not willing to kill the Senate bill to do it. And I'm also not willing to buy this meme that keeps being floated that the Obama administration is a betrayal of progressive ideals and they do nothing to support it. This kind of blanket statements, I'm not going to buy it. I don't let it float, and I don't think that. And I think that contributes to this idea that people are going to vote the other way or not vote at all.
Okay.
And you've got to fight that.
The reason I called though is because, 6 months ago, the talking heads and pundits in the Village in D.C. on TV were like, "Oh, don't worry about the public option; it's dead. You know, the liberals always cave. That's a joke." And I was wondering how something that polls 60-70% approval, which both Medicare buy-in and public option still to this day poll, how these guys 6 months ago were just, you know, looking at the polls, we're saying it's immensely popular, still 20 to 30 points more popular than Obama's health care plan overall. How these guys in D.C. and the pundits and the Chris Matthews were so, you know, prescient to know 6 months ago this wasn't going to be in is because the when the liberals cave and then they're expected to cave again and they continue to cave, it just reinforces the cycle. And so, like, the unions, I feel sorry for them. I'm in a state that doesn't allow unions.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys look like the biggest idiots in the world because there's no way they're getting card check.
Right.
I mean, and they look like idiots. Like, I think it's Stern from SEIU looks like the biggest idiot supporting this health care plan that's going to tax his workers. You know, this excise tax on the, quote, Cadillac
well, that's
plan.
It. Yeah, right. That's the one that's in the Senate plan. Totally. But like I said, we're still getting through committee on this. And then and I want to, you know, I think they're learning the kind of law of give and take in this. There's a lot of upside. And I got to go because we're running up against the end of the show. But there are a lot of issues all happening at once. One of the reasons why we voted for Obama and one of the reasons why we mobilized so much is because this country was in such dire straits because of the last 8 years. The concept that we're going to be able to extract ourselves smoothly, quickly, and painlessly from it without any kind of, you know, push is I think, fundamentally naive. And I think our earlier callers, and Emma included, were great in saying that we need to focus on getting more progressives in the House. If I could have a House, Senate full of Al Frankens, I can't tell you how happy I would be about that fact. And I think you would be, too. So let that drive you to actually be involved. And if you have any problems with the bills as they come along, let yourself be even more involved. I'm Hal Sparks. I will see you tomorrow on The Stephanie Miller Show. 1-800-STEPH12 is our number. HalSparks.com, @HalSparks on Twitter.